Great to see everyone this morning, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. My name is Eliza Barclay. I commission and edit op-eds on climate and environment for the New York Times. I'm going to thank you, David, for providing us with an excellent pun. To start off this panel, it's going to be a gas. We're going to talk about
hydrogen. Oh, gosh.
I personally was not really following hydrogen as like a core issue in the climate conversation. It seemed like these guys have all been following it for a long time, but to me it feels as though it only recently has become a kind of major part of the conversation. So I wanted to just provide a little framing around why it is that we're now talking about hydrogen so much, as well as advanced nuclear and what this panel is going to get into. The federal government is now, and the private sector are now making tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, of dollars in investments to push certain sectors to decarbonize faster. And one of those is hydrogen. A lot of entities, government, private sector, are placing a big bet on hydrogen now. And the possibility is that it could help us decarbonize certain industrial activities, steel, fertilizer, chemicals, perhaps long-haul trucks that now depend on fossil fuels. It's a versatile fuel. A pound of hydrogen has about 3 times as much energy as a comparable amount of diesel or gasoline. And the Inflation Reduction Act really wants to drive the cost of hydrogen way down. And so it's going to be providing a lot of tax incentives and grants, perhaps as much as $100 billion combined with other recent legislation, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. And the International Energy Agency is really counting on hydrogen to help us get to net zero by 2050. Green hydrogen, clean, we're going to talk about the lingo in this panel. It is absolutely part of our long-term plans to get to net zero. Hydrogen has got to be part of it. Nuclear energy also, of course, could provide us with stable, it could continue if we build more. In a best-case scenario, give us a stable, always-on source of zero-carbon electricity. Nuclear reactors don't take up a lot of space. They provide a large amount of energy. There's a lot of opportunity there. And also, the International Energy Agency says we need nuclear if we're going to get to net zero. We need to double capacity by 2050. There are now these newer reactors, modular reactors, that are designed to be less expensive, easier to build than the traditional ones. They're being proposed by several manufacturers. In fact, in January, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission gave its final approval for a design from a company called NuScale. David's written quite a bit about this company. We'll hear more about it. And there's a sort of regional tie-in that this company is going to go ahead and build a cluster of 6 77-megawatt small modular reactors here in Idaho on the grounds of the Department of Energy's Idaho National Laboratory. So just as a point of comparison, a regular nuclear reactor produces 1,000 megawatts. These small ones produce 77 megawatts, so they're much smaller. And it's going to be potentially a proof of concept, but these small reactors would eventually supply the Utah power grid if all goes well. And also, by the way, with nuclear, something I recently learned is that the Department of Energy believes that we could build a lot of small nuclear reactors on the site of current coal power plants. So there's a lot of excitement about, putting in nuclear where we currently have coal plants. But there's a lot of buts here. These are technologies, new technologies. Some of them have been around, some of them are evolving. Newer generations of technologies that also have come with like a lot of risk. There are industries involved here that stand to make a lot of money from these technologies. they will have opportunities to cut corners going forward. And so, you know, figuring out how to make hydrogen work in our current energy system is very hard, as these guys know well, very complicated. And I think it, to me, this conversation is in a bigger way about accepting, acknowledging that decarbonization involves like a lot of gambles. We are placing bets on new technologies, and we have to, right? But it's uncomfortable, and there are a lot of concerns that we can raise about nuclear hydrogen, whether these will be boondoggles or not. And so, you know, I think part of thinking through these technologies, their potential is partly about, you know, what can we stomach, what can we tolerate, what shouldn't we stomach, what do we have to do now to avert unintended consequences. We don't want hydrogen to end up giving us lots more fossil fuel emissions, which is possible if we do it poorly. Or maybe if we embrace nuclear too quickly, it could be extremely expensive and take way too long, and then we wasted a lot of time. So we're going to talk about all these things, and I have a great panel here. Peter is a freelance journalist. He's been covering climate and energy for 25 years. He's contributed to The Atlantic, Scientific American, MIT Tech Review. He's received awards from SEJ and covering climate now. Jack Brower is professor at UC Irvine in California and director of its Clean Energy Institute. David Schlissel is director of resource planning analysis at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. They're each going to give, since this is technical stuff, and I think it's helpful to have some of the facts to understand these technologies before we get into some of the nuances, they're each going to give a short presentation. And I didn't even mention how the grid fits into all of this, but it's a huge part of it. Peter's going to talk about that. So David, please kick us off.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me if I stand up here? I've never been told I talk too softly.
I kind of want you to have the microphone for the recording.
Mic. Yeah. I blow your ears out.
For the recording.
Oh, there's a lapel. Here's the one you can walk around with.
Okay, great. Let me just start.
Okay, it's not on.
It's.
Yeah.
How do I turn?
Yeah, I'll get it here. Go ahead.
That's why we have an electrical engineer.
The smartest thing to do is sit next to a college professor. He knows how.
Okay, you got to put it close to your mouth, though.
Okay. How's it? All right. I have to admit, I disagree with the first half of what Eliza said. We don't need blue hydrogen. It's going to end up putting more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We don't need small modular reactors. The nuclear industry has a history of overpromising and underproducing. You can get my sense, what I think about small modular reactors from the title of our first report, which is February 2022. Small modular reactors, too risky, too uncertain, too expensive, and too late. I have to go through both these industries, or technologies in 5 to 7 minutes. So if you have questions, please ask them when I'm done. Okay, blue hydrogen. Does everybody here know? Who doesn't know what blue hydrogen is? Please, don't be embarrassed. Okay, great. There are different colors now being talked about with hydrogen. If you make it from a fossil fuel, either natural gas, which is essentially methane, or coal, it's gray hydrogen. If you use carbon capture to reduce your CO2 emissions, it's blue. If you use renewables, it's green. There's now a turquoise, and there's a black carbon.
Purple, white, yellow, pink.
Yeah, the pink is from nuclear power. The power comes from nuclear power plants.
I'll have a slide on that.
Sorry, I have to. 5 years ago, roughly 3 years ago, the world caught a fever. And I'm not talking about COVID. The fever was, hey, hydrogen can cure everything from giving us electricity steel to the common cold. I mean, really, you talk to Michael Lembrecht is famous in the energy field. He helped found Bloomberg New Energy. He calls it a cult. And he believes that the cult of hydrogen will burn out, hopefully, by the beginning of the next decade. So here are the three ways that I think we're probably going to focus on today. There's gray, blue, and green. Now, Mike, I decided, since I didn't have much time, I'd write down my key takeaways. Probably the smartest thing I've done this morning. Without carbon capture, blue hydrogen is very dirty. Producing it is extremely dirty, emitting on the order of 9 or 10 or more kilograms of CO2 into the atmosphere without per kilogram of hydrogen. Although the industry, and this includes vendors, coal, oil and gas, and the government now, talk about carbon capture as having been proven, it really hasn't. The technology, and you'll see a slide in a little bit, the goal is to capture all or almost all of the CO2 produced in a blue hydrogen facility, actually produced in any place, for decarbonization. That has been achieved, but only on small-scale testing. As Eliza mentioned, a large nuclear plant is 1,000 megawatts electric. Coal and gas plants are more like 400 to 800. The scale we're talking about for the tests are originally 1.5 megawatts or that are 12 megawatts. Very small, and scaling up in new technologies is a real problem, any new technology. Blue hydrogen facilities may not be clean even if they capture 90% or more of the CO2 they produce. And then the last two key takeaways, methane and hydrogen are very potent greenhouse gases. Methane, over the first two decades after it's released, is 83 to 88% more potent than CO2. Over 100 years, it's 25 times. For hydrogen, it's 25 times more potent over the first decades, and then that declines to roughly 11. The key thing about hydrogen is it's very tiny. As you know, it's the smallest molecule, atom and molecule. It leaks everywhere. Well, we think it leaks everywhere because there's no commercially available technology that can measure hydrogen leakage. So the world, and it's not only the U.S., is proceeding to develop a technology that today we can't tell. We know it's bad, but we can't tell how bad it is. Let's see. I've pretty much run through the other slides. I'm happy to share these with everybody, and I'm actually going to ask Eliza for the list of everybody who's here, and I will send you the presentation. This is an example. This is a real-world check. The two sets of bars on the left are two of the three hydrogen production facilities in the world that currently capture CO2. They're not capturing anywhere near 95% of it. Now, there's a reason for that. They're not trying. Because there's been no incentives. The incentives haven't been big enough. Even if they do better, to quote a line from Neil Armstrong, it will be a giant leap for mankind and womankind to get from their levels up to 95%. On the right are two sets of bars from two coal plants that promise 90% capture. The one on the left was Petra Nova was mothballed. It's coming back into operation. And the one on the right is up in Saskatchewan. I talked about hydrogen and methane leakage. Now small modular reactors. Key takeaways. None of them have been built.
Well, actually, a couple small ones are built in Russia on an icebreaker. But they're nothing like the designs that are going to be used and is being proposed for the rest of the world. There's been one under construction in Argentina for 14 years, which kind of gives you a little insight into how difficult they might be. The new SMR designs most likely will not be available for a decade. Let's see, none have been built or operated. The construction costs of most of the SMR designs have not been made public, which is, should make you suspicious. However, the estimated cost of the new scale SMR has already more than doubled, and they're still 3 years away from starting construction. And I'll show you quickly a couple of slides that will show you relative cost of power. This is an SMR. Liza did a great job of describing it without the picture in front of her. You can see that instead of one large reactor in the cutaway, this is like half of a 12 modular SMR. Again, that's planned, not built. There are cost and schedule uncertainties. I could talk from now until noon about how bad the nuclear industry has been at predicting cost and schedule. This is that new scale SMR cost increase. You can see that since 2015 to 2023, the cost in current year, same year dollars, 2022 dollars has more than doubled. When we issued our report last year, they said we didn't know what we were talking about. Of course, the cost wasn't going to go up. They announced about 2 months ago the cost had doubled. One of the reporters, Aaron, she may be here, called me the other day and asked me if I wanted her to ask any questions of New Scale. And I said, you ask if they're going to apologize. It was a joke. This is a comparison of the currently estimated cost of the New Scale power from New Scale is $89 a megawatt hour. That reflects $30 of subsidies from the Inflation Reduction Act.
David, sorry, if you can just wrap up.
1 minute. Yeah, this is the last slide.
Okay.
It's much more expensive than projected cost of power from renewables, which, by the way, don't include any of the new subsidy. I mean, there are some major subsidies for renewables, but these numbers that I got from the federal government don't include those. And then lastly, ask me about this one.
All right.
All right, thank you very much. I can tell this is not a room full of engineers because we have people spread out nicely all over the room and even sitting in the front row. Anyways, I'm here to talk about hydrogen and its features, and I believe they are essential for us to achieve our zero emissions policy goals. And I'm not the only one. That's why all of these jurisdictions all around the world are agreeing to spend billions, if not $100 or $200 billion all around the world in this vector. And I'll try to explain why. In California today, we have the most solar of any state in the nation. And yet it's only providing at this moment 14% of our total energy. And our plans for the future to get to a zero emissions grid involve primarily installing solar and batteries. And you can see that in the right-hand side of this chart where the green and blue colors are solar and the gray color is batteries. So we absolutely know we must install way more solar power than we currently have. And as a matter of fact, the historical installation of solar, shown in this slide, shows that we're putting in about 1 to 2 gigawatts of solar capacity every year, historically. And if you plot that, like I did right here, that's the blue data that you see here. Blue data, that's our current trajectory for solar install. But the plan is reflected in the orange and red. So what you can see is that with the current policy framework, we are going to only achieve 1/3 to 1/2 of the solar capacity we need. to meet our zero emissions policy goals in California. So we must have alternate vectors and investments in transmission and distribution if we're ever going to achieve our policy goals. As a matter of fact, you can see that the capacity range we need is way higher than the current trajectory suggests. And this is being reported on. You can see here, this is a utility dive report from March 30, 2023. And it shows that as California grid interconnection requests triple, analysts are trying to figure out how we're going to handle this influx. And as a matter of fact, you can see here that the CAISO, this is our independent system operator of the grid in California, they're making new plans to introduce more transmission and distribution so that we can start to get onto the pace of solar installation that we need. As a matter of fact, they are used to receiving 1 gigawatt of requests. Last year, they received 2 gigawatts of requests, and they couldn't handle them all. They couldn't handle them. And they're planning now, you can see at the very end here, 7,000 megawatts per year. And again, this is consistent with the CARB suggestion that we got to have way more solar. Okay, so this is where hydrogen fits. Oh, by the way, we also are paying people to take our electricity. Negative prices throughout the southern pool, okay, which you can see here, southwest pool, and California ISO are going negative more than 200 million times in the last year. So in other words, 200 million times at 5-minute intervals, we're paying people to take our renewable electricity. Even with that paying people to take the electricity, we have curtailment. And this curtailment is going up exponentially. You can see we have over almost 600,000 megawatt hours just in April last year that we threw away. So paying people to take our solar and throwing away our solar is what's going on in California today. Okay, so what do we need? We need investments like crazy in transmission and distribution. If we don't do that, we can't keep installing solar at this pace. We can't jump onto that higher pace of adding solar. And we need, I suggest, alternate vectors for electrification. Alternate vectors. What do I mean by that? This is where hydrogen comes in. Oh, by the way, it's worth a lot of money. About $600 million retail, all this electricity we threw away, and it could have made 45 million kilograms of hydrogen, which would have fueled 207,000 cars for a whole year last year. Okay, so why does hydrogen come in to this picture of the electric grid? Well, it comes in because by far and away, the most important way that we're going to make hydrogen all around the world in the future is by electrolysis. This is a process by which we take electricity and we convert water into its constituent elements, oxygen and hydrogen. Okay, why do I say this is by far and away the most important thing? It's because all around the world we must install solar and wind. We're not going to be using fossil 100 years from now. Even if our policies fail, we're going to be out of this stuff. It's going to be gone. Besides the fact that it's important to immediately remove fossil from our infrastructure. And the biggest way we're going to make them renewable, green, and I mean green in the traditional sense, hydrogen, is via water electrolysis. Sun and wind power is available all around the world more equitably than the fossil is, and it's available almost everywhere. Okay, so this is how the process works. It's an electrochemical reaction that converts water on one side to oxygen, on the other side to hydrogen. Okay, this is the most important way to make hydrogen. Now, we heard David talk about the colors. Okay, this is a kind of listing of all the colors. You'll be able to see this later. Green, blue, gray, brown, black, turquoise, pink, yellow, white. Okay, from my perspective, we all like colors of the rainbow. Yeah, and we like a shorthand. It's easier to talk about colors than it is to talk about the environmental features. From my perspective, the colors are misleading. Within each color, you have various levels of emissions. So let's characterize hydrogen on its emissions characteristics. The carbon intensity, the criteria pollutant emissions intensity. This is what we should do, and I think smart jurisdictions all around the world are doing this. Okay, so why do we need hydrogen then? One of the reasons we need it is for the feature of separate power and energy scaling, which is the ability to make massive energy storage when you have a small amount of power each day. Okay, so power is small, but energy is massive. And that's what this simulation we did for 100% renewable California grid shows. This is showing that we have enough solar energy, we have enough wind power that we can harvest to actually make it through the whole year. It's not a problem that the resource is not available, we just need to install wind turbines and solar panels. If we do, we have certain times, and I'm showing them here, where we have deficits of power throughout the whole year. And we have other times when we have surpluses throughout the whole year. And we have more surplus than deficit. So we can make it through the year. All we have to do is store it, move it around. And the way we do it today is pumped hydro. It also has separate power and energy scaling. That's why we use it mostly for grid scale storage. Right? The size of the lakes are the size of the energy. The size of the turbines are the size of the power. That's the kind of storage we need. Some people say batteries are going to work. This is how much energy the batteries could store if all 21 million EVs, 21 million cars in California were made EVs and not used for driving, but just grid storage. So you can see already battery energy storage is pretty small in its ability to carry this massive amount of energy. Hydrogen's the only resource that is grid scale with regard to the amount of energy we need for a 100% renewable grid. You can see here, this is just converting current gas storage facilities into hydrogen. It's the only one that can do this seasonal storage. And again, it's because this separate power and energy scaling feature of hydrogen enables that. Besides, delivering energy via wires and pipes is always going to be more resilient and reliable than only delivering it via wires. That's the way we make our grid reliable today, is with gas and electricity. And there are some end uses that require the features of hydrogen, like anything that requires rapid fueling, long range, or heavy payload. This is why people are saying it belongs in heavy industry and heavy transport and freight. It's lighter than batteries as the other zero emissions option. And there are certain industries that absolutely can't be converted to zero emissions without hydrogen and its features, like high temperature heat, feedstock, meaning it needs the chemical H2, okay? Or reducing gas, that is a gas that can react with the process, like in cement and in steel, to actually convert the oxides to steel or calcium oxides, if calcium carbonate. Okay, so there are certain industries that need hydrogen features. Okay, I can't talk about all the features, but read this paper. It's called Hydrogen is Essential for Sustainability. There's 11 features that we describe in that. Okay, I was also asked to talk about hydrogen hubs. This is the $9 billion that was set aside in the bipartisan infrastructure law called now the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. They are funding regional hydrogen hubs all around the country. And I was a co-author to the California Regional Hydrogen Hub application, and this is some information that you can see from it. But the key thing here is that we plan in California to go from 2023, where we have 6,800 tons per year that are made, to 16 million tons per year of hydrogen. And the key thing is that will enable, okay, this kind of use of it in marine applications. You can see this port up here. It will enable it in heavy-duty truck applications. It will enable it in grid storage and in power generation. Okay, so these are the kinds of sectors that we're using it in. And here you can see like the regions in which we are making it, in the Northern California, North Central Valley, South Central Valley, and Southern California, and then the sectors that we will plan to use it in. Okay, final thing. We are doing a pretty good job in many jurisdictions around the world to decarbonize and depollute our electric grid. The California example is repeated all around the world. We're able to use, we're about 50% renewables total, if you count large hydro, wind, solar, geothermal. You put it all together, we're about 50% renewables on the grid. How much decarbonization have we put into those diesel applications? How much have we put into ships, long-haul trucks, trains? Less than 1%. This is the critical urgent need that we face today, from my perspective. And it's one that has no other known zero emissions alternative than hydrogen. Hydrogen is the only known zero emissions option that can do international shipping. The only one. And what is happening when we fight hydrogen is we are supporting the continued use of diesel. And this is what happens when we use diesel, is we kill people. We have a severe challenge of air quality and consequential health benefits. We need to eliminate diesel wherever we can. This sort of simulation that we did shows if we used hydrogen instead of diesel in Southern California, we save lives. So from my perspective, climate is a huge motivation, but I think air quality is even a bigger motivation for adopting hydrogen as a vector. Thank you for your time.
I'll get your presentation. Thank you so much.
Good morning. I'll be quick because we're running a little behind, and it would be nice to have time for all of your questions. I'm going to just talk quickly about power grids because it's cross-cutting and there's a lot of next-gen opportunities for you to write about. And frankly, I think their near-term importance is paramount. Let's see. This is me. This is why I'm here. So quickly, what is the grid? It's a nested set of networks that exchange electricity. What do I mean by that? So you've got different levels going all the way from the power plants and the biggest power lines all the way down to the little black box that connects from the wall outlet to your computer. Okay, all of that is electrically connected, and one can say it's essentially part of the grid. The transmission grid is the big one. That's what we'll be mostly talking about today. This shows all of the biggest lines across North America. I put this slide up just for fun, partially because it's from the US government and it shows that the lines cross into Canada, which is amazing. That the border, we actually crossed the border there. And yet, it neglected Mexico entirely. And in fact, the interconnected AC grid does go down into Baja California, so they've screwed that up. Anyway, so these are the big power lines. There's a couple ways you can understand the grid. One is on this level. Another is on this level. Okay, see those dotted lines? Those separate areas of AC grid, okay? And we call these interconnects. So you've got basically everything west of the Rockies and everything east of the Rockies except for Texas. So these are areas where all of the big power lines within each area, all of the big power lines are mostly AC, alternating current, and power flows between them freely based on the laws of physics and resistance, okay? The dotted lines are where one AC grid meets another one. Power cannot flow between them, okay? They're all 60 hertz. They've all got AC signals that are similar, but they're out of phase with each other, okay? In order to cross those divides, you need DC power, the kind of stuff that comes out of a solar panel or goes into your computer, okay? And that requires electronics, and there are very big power electronic stations that can mediate between these grids, all right? So that's another way of thinking about the grid. Here's a third way. In the US, and this bleeds over into Canada, our AC grids are broken up into various regional markets. So this isn't this is less of a physical idea, although it has a physical manifestation, but it's more of a how you operate the system and how you buy and sell power within these areas. So California has its own, you've got ERCOT, that's Texas, all right? So within ERCOT, You've got power plants buying and vying for the market, okay? And you've got one operator that's managing that market and managing how the power lines operate. You can see that when you look at the areas where the market is within, or if you look between the AC zones, like Texas is one AC zone, right? There's almost no transfer capacity between Texas and its neighbors, okay? That's because you need DC technology to make that crossing, and because Texas doesn't want to exchange power, and so they haven't installed that equipment. Same if you look at the line down the Rockies, okay? There's almost no power flowing across between the East, North America, and West North America, okay? Again, you need DC electronics. Those exist, but they're very small. All right, so that's the transmission grid. I think of the grid as like a fractal, where, you know, you can keep looking in and it keeps getting denser as you go down. So below the transmission grid, you have distribution grids, right? Every city and town will have its own complex network that's taking the power from the big lines and spreading it out. And then even within your home, essentially, you have a grid that's sending power around. Okay, so why is the grid so important? There are three mores. We're using more electricity, right? We want to replace our heating and our transportation. We want to get rid of that diesel and that natural gas. We're switching to more renewable energy, and that creates new challenges. Renewable energy makes less efficient use of the grid because it operates less frequently or less consistently. So in a sense, if you need a bigger line to accommodate your solar and wind farms, but they may not be operating all the time. And it brings some different technology challenges, and then we've got more weather, okay? As weather gets more extreme, you would like to be able to, you're gonna have situations where you don't have enough local electricity, and you'd like to be able to bring it in from outside. As we saw, for example, with the big storms that took out the Texas grid a couple of years ago, right? Because they had no exchange capacity with their neighbors, they were screwed, and people died. All right. So in terms of the stories that I hope you all will join me in writing, there are stories about how we need more grid, and we've heard a lot about this in the plenary sessions, right? Because we're trying to build renewables at a pace that we've never even conceived before. That power needs lines to get onto, and it needs lines to move across regions. So that means, you know, stories about how we should be planning further ahead, how we should be planning for longer lines. Can we do permitting faster? Very controversial, but even you'll see environmental advocates starting to talk about how we can do things faster, and we have to do things faster. And then there's next gen type grid stories where you're talking about technology. You can look at these later. We've heard about hydrogen. I want to just talk about the fourth item there, high voltage direct current. So I was in China a couple of years ago writing a story about their move into very high, ultra-high voltage DC power. And this gives you a picture. This is a couple of years old now. There are more. These are lines that are up to or over 3,000 kilometers long that China has today and started building 20 years ago that take very large amounts of hydropower from the southwest, coal power and wind power and solar power from the northwest and the north, and bring it down to that heavily industrialized east coast. And here's what America could have. And this is something that I'm writing again about right now, so I have to be careful not to give away my story. But there's plenty of room to write about this. So there's a concept of what's called a macro grid, in which we say, you know what, it's going to take us too long to increase the AC grid. We need better technology that's designed to move power over long distances very efficiently. Let's build an even bigger grid on top of today's grid so that we can, when Texas is having a massive storm and the wind has died, it can pull power from California or from the Great Plains, and people won't die.
Yeah.
So that's it for me. There are some of my stories. Hope we have a great discussion.
Okay, so we're almost, it's almost time for audience questions, but I guess I can get one question in here before we open it up. So, as we've talked a lot about at this conference, we're already having a hard time adding renewables to the grid. There's a lot of backlog projects, and if we want to make hydrogen with low greenhouse gas intensity, we need a lot more renewable energy. So it's a kind of a two-part question. One is, you know, what is your, all of your confidence that we can do that? We can actually get a lot more renewable energy up and running to make hydrogen. And I guess hydrogen being this amazing Swiss Army knife, it can also help with the big picture of renewable energy storage, as Jack explained. And then at the same time, I wanted to ask about the fact, what David talked about at the offset, that outset, that currently we use a lot of fossil fuels to make hydrogen. And so one question that comes up a lot is, and I worked with Leah Stokes on a piece about this recently, is that if we're not careful, we could end up continuing to make hydrogen with a lot of fossil fuels. So how do we avoid that, and how do we think, how can we think through this challenge of getting up all this additional renewable energy just to make hydrogen?
So let me say that I think I'm about 50% confident that we can actually install renewables at the appropriate pace to even just meet the electrical demands that we have for the future. So it's a pretty huge challenge that we don't have sufficient policies for today to actually accomplish, right? That's why the trajectory that we're on today is not going to get us to the zero emissions promise that we've made. Secondly, this unfortunately, the bipartisan infrastructure law supports low carbon and names fossil as something they want to support. Okay, so this is, I think, what was just done for political reasons, but it's unfortunate. And what's going to happen then is there will be some blue hydrogen, some hydrogen with carbon capture and storage that I think is not a long-term solution, that we shouldn't really be investing in. And I agree with some of David's comments with regard to that. It's not a long-term vector. And it involves both the upstream emissions of methane, right, forever, right, if we keep doing it that way, and carbon capture. We're not too confident that's going to always be the best thing. From my perspective, the only benefit that could bring is better carbon capture and storage technologies, which IPCC has identified, especially with bioenergy carbon capture and storage, BECCS, as required for us to stay below 2 degrees. And even that's also very risky, or not necessarily possible. So let me just say, though, if you look at the models for how we expect the size of the market to evolve over time for both the renewable energy inputs and for the electrolysis and hydrogen production technologies, I think we have the possibility of a zero emissions future that will have energy delivered at lower prices than we have today. It's possible. If you look at scientific ways of determining costs versus time and size of markets, they're going to go below what we're doing for fossil today. So I'm optimistic that this future is possible, okay? I just don't think we have the policies in place right now to do it.
I'm I'm very pessimistic about the capability of the political systems around the world to do it. Look at what we're talking about today. We're talking about the government. I mean, I agree basically with everything Jack said about green energy and the need for more transmission. But licensing reform, permitting reform, means at the federal level cutting out the people who live in the communities that are going to be affected by new facilities. That's what licensing reform means. It means in places like Louisiana's chemical alley, it means that all those poor and people of color communities are going to be, if there was the licensing reform that's being discussed in Congress, they're excluded from the process. But we desperately need licensing reform to get more transmission. But the basic flaw, I mean, it started with Obama, who I loved. It's continuing with Biden, who I can't admit to loving so much, but I like him. The do-it-all, we have to do everything strategy. And then we give lots of money, lots of incentives to, shall we say, the oil and gas industry, who got us in this mess, who for 20, 30, 40 years knew this was coming. They know it's coming today. And they're trying to cut back what we're spending from the IRA. So we're giving, I'm going to say people, only because the Supreme Court declared that corporations are people. We're giving money and incentives to the corporations who got us here. We're giving huge amounts of money to the nuclear industry, who 40 years ago, excuse me, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, underestimated the cost of building new nukes by a factor of three. They were three times more expensive, took it on average twice as long to build. So in the 1990s, what happened? The nuclear industry came back and said, well, we've decided to do modular construction. We've learned our lessons. And now we've got a new generation of nuclear plants. What did we get out of that? Two nuclear plants finishing up construction in Georgia called Vogtle Units 3 and 4 that are now $20 billion over budget and 7 years late. And now we're back to the same thing about, well, we're going to give a lot of money because all these new designs that have never built, been built or never been operated, not even built. It's insanity. We have technology. Do what's cheap and easy now, what Jack talked about. Build the infrastructure. Put in as fast and as quickly renewables as we can. Battery storage is taking leaps and bounds. Do that stuff first. And then, you want to do a couple of nuke designs, sure. Keep doing research. Same thing with, forget blue hydrogen. Forget using fossil fuels. That's really what we need to do.
I'll just try to inject a quick bit of optimism. and note that Europe... went through a pretty painful debate about blue versus green hydrogen over the last couple of years, and I think it's pretty clear that green has kicked blue's ass there. I mean, they don't have a big oil and gas industry as big as we have, and so they're not as powerful a force. And I would also point to Australia, where I've done some recent reporting. There's been a real quick flip away from the idea of trying to get hydrogen out of coal to going gangbusters with their amazing solar and wind resources. And that's the entire focus of the green hydrogen juggernaut there, which is massive, mm-hmm. is yep. green hydrogen.
Awesome. All right, we'll open it up. So SEJ and J Group members, you get to go first. Please identify yourselves as you ask a question. And no speeches. I also will ask the panelists to please keep your responses short.
Should I deliver this to people?
Maybe.
Okay. Maybe someone else can do that.
You want to be delivering?
I'll do it. Yes.
Thank you, Frank.
I think she raised her hand first, right there.
Hi, I'm Emily. I cover energy for the Texas Tribune, and I've done a lot of reporting about what's going to happen in light of that winter storm that Peter mentioned. And in Texas, they seem to be leaning right now toward building more natural gas, and they have no interest in joining the rest of the grid. So I wondered, is there a way that Texas could be forced? So, like, this national grid that you were talking about could be forced into happening, or are there other ways you see these regional decisions being overridden?
So, Texas is one of the reasons, or the main reason why they're not connected with the rest of the country is because they don't want to be under the jurisdiction of FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, okay? And they have been told that they can make connections with their neighbors and not come under that jurisdiction. But I think they're still sort of hiding under that. I think there are power industry interests who don't want to see connection. This is one of the things with transmission. Fundamentally, transmission equalizes markets and increasing competition. Okay, so when you build transmission lines and connect two regions, you enable the power generators in those regions to serve all the consumers. Right, you enable power plants in one place to now start competing to meet the load in another place. If you're an incumbent power generator, you don't want that. And so I think Texas is just, at this point, classic protectionism. And it's bad for business in Texas. There are academic folks you can find who will tell you that Texas stands to make a lot of money by building more wind power that it can export, more solar power that it can export if it has the lines to do it. So I think that the best hope is that ultimately Texas's economic self-interest leads to that border being traversed.
What's happening in, can you hear me okay? What's happening in Texas is pretty, I don't know what the word is, interesting, unique. If we asked you, which is the largest state with renewables, pursuing renewables? Everybody would say California. No,
it's
Texas.
Texas.
That's why oil and gas wants the state of Texas to build 10,000 megawatts of new gas. It's got nothing to do with protecting people from outages. In fact, during the big outage in February of 2021, solar overproduced. And the western part of Texas is actually connected to the Western Interconnect. They had some problems, but very, very few compared to the rest of the state. No, the oil and gas industry doesn't want to lose their pet place in the market. That's all this is about. Got nothing.
Yeah.
And the transition to renewables is going to keep going in Texas really fast.
Okay. Next question is over here. You're going to pick.
Hi, I'm Adelon. I'm a reporter in California for Capital Maine. David, you and I actually spoke a few weeks ago. We'll maybe talk after this. I had two questions. First one, maybe for Peter. Looking at electricity within a city, if there are pockets that might be disadvantaged, you know, that might have access to less power, I'm still learning more about the grid at the local level, but curious if that could be an issue going forward. And then next question for Jack and David, what are some smart questions to ask about green hydrogen? BP, other oil companies are starting to invest in it, so curious if there's, you know, smart questions to be asked.
Thanks, that's a really interesting question. And it's one that I think few people are thinking about, and that the industry isn't used to thinking about or being asked about. I think there's some really interesting research that came out of the Texas, what was the winter storm Uri, right? There's research that suggests that disadvantaged, or you know, communities of color suffered more rolling blackouts during that storm than neighboring communities, which is really interesting. So you know, there wasn't enough power to go around, and the communities with the lowest, you know, least amount of political power got the least amount of electricity. That's really interesting research, and I think there should be more written about it. And I, you know, going forward, there is a need for strengthening of the local grids. If you want to you know, put in big charging stations for electric cars, for example, or a truck fleet or a bus fleet, there's a lot of energy required, and that probably is going to require reinforcement of the local grid. And you know, who pays for that, and which neighborhoods get that first, I think that's all up for grabs and probably the fodder for good local reporting.
Yeah, and with regard to good questions to ask regarding investments in green hydrogen, one of the things that you could ask is about the cost of it, because nowadays, if you connect solar directly up to electrolyzers at their current price and you get a certain capacity factor, it's pretty expensive. And so we know that we need to invest in innovations, and we need to grow the renewable market further so that those costs keep coming down. Now, you have to remember, solar panels are way down on the cost curve, whereas electrolyzers are still way up here. They're still basically a super tiny market. So we do expect them to come down pretty quickly, but that kind of a cost question, I think, is a good one. Another one is carbon and emissions intensity of that hydrogen, because once you make the hydrogen, how are you going to deliver it to the end uses? Maybe you're going to use a diesel truck. Yeah. Literally, to move it to where it needs to go, and all these kinds of things. Those logistics, unless you put it into a pipeline or something like that, make a big difference with regard to carbon intensity, emissions intensity. And again, I like to focus on those, carbon intensity, criteria pollutant, emissions intensity of any kind of hydrogen.
One concern about green hydrogen, water. How are areas that, I mean, the whole western part of the U.S. Has been in a drought. California was until we got like 5 weeks of solid rain. We're not guaranteed that's going to change in the future. So that is a concern. I think we have to do as much green hydrogen as we can in areas that can support it. Desalinization. Use some of the energy to desalinize ocean water.
I agree. Water is a great question. A lot of people are using wastewater and salt water nowadays. But this is a really nice direction that the community is heading in. So, we have another question in here. I'm trying to just move things along. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. Should I?
Yeah.
Steve Chappell with the Hot Globe Substack, but also with Scripps Oceanography and the Samuel Lawrence Foundation. Liquidity. They're very concerned about waste, which is the one thing you haven't talked about. Thorium, small nuclear reactors are three times as wasteful, and there's a view that you're just distributing something around the country with distributed nuclear, and it's become a huge issue in Southern California. So could you hit the waste thing? It seemed like the nail in that particular coffin wasn't mentioned.
I don't know. The nuclear industry has shown a Dracula-like ability to be stabbed through the heart with a stake and still survive and still come back strong. So I don't know. But waste is certainly a concern. I mean, if you add 500 new nuclear reactors around the country, and that's what some of the plans are talking about, you're going to have not only waste driving down the street, or are they going to store it there? That's what happens now. Also, it's concerned ability of it, when the SMRs are not only being sold here, they're being sold all around the world.
to some regimes we don't like so much and some that are not as stable, and many that are not democratic. So what happens if that stuff falls into the hands of terrorists? So I think the concern about terrorism and the concern about waste are very serious. I happen to not be worried about nuclear power other than waste, terrorism, and cost. No, it's not. Some people are afraid if they drive, you know, they're driving on Interstate 95 north of Boston by the Seabrook nuclear power plant, it's going to blow up while they're driving. No, I don't think if it's, they're well managed and well built. They won't do that, but there are serious issues with them.
There's a back here. Yeah, the microphone.
Yeah.
Molly Seltzer with Princeton University. I was curious about the transportation implications of hydrogen. You mentioned it a little bit, but you know, I've been following a little bit about some ideas about maybe like moving hydrogen via ammonia, and then just making it on demand. But also some concerns about just the high pressure that you need for storage and other things.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak about that, Jack, obviously, but also the whole panel, because I know that's a really big concern.
So hydrogen is not nearly so easy to move around in society as our current infrastructure fuels. You're correct. We have to pressurize it to very high pressures to get enough energy on board a car or a truck. This is probably one of the most significant challenges with regard to using it in transportation applications. I do believe it can be very safe, even though we do that. And the analogous situation is compressed natural gas, as an example, although hydrogen has to be compressed even higher. Okay, but if you look at the safety scenarios associated with that, I think it's going to be safer than gasoline in the end. Okay, it still has a big risk associated with this high pressure. Okay, a second thing is moving it around in different forms like ammonia. So ammonia ends up being, of course, a lot easier to carry around from a physical perspective because at low pressure it's a liquid. Okay, and so it ends up behaving more like the traditional liquid fuels for moving the energy around, but then you have the toxicity issue, and if you have any leaks, and you know that there's lots of industrial accidents that involve ammonia. So it's very, very difficult for me to envision it going into consumers' hands, but it might be moved internationally as ammonia. So I think the most likely scenario is that you're gonna have these carriers that are not given to people, okay, but given to shipping companies to move it from Saudi Arabia to Los Angeles or something like that. Okay, so I think it's kind of going to go in that direction. We don't want people to fuel with ammonia at the gas station. I'm suggesting.
Christine Heinrichs, reporting for Go Green Nation and KCBX. The West Coast has plans for ambitious and expansive floating offshore wind projects that require substantial onshore infrastructure investments. How does floating offshore wind fit into grid improvements, and what's the carbon footprint of that? Thanks.
But let me make a few comments on that because I'm doing research actively on this very topic. One thing is that we have a few interconnections that could possibly be used. One of them is where San Onofre was retired. Another one is where Diablo Canyon is and may be retired. Okay, so there's pretty interesting ideas there with regard to using that. Secondly, we could offshore make hydrogen from the seawater. And then you could use the hydrogen in ships from that offshore wind. I think this is a very early stage idea. Not too many people are talking about that. But third, and probably most importantly, is we have to invest in additional transmission infrastructure. Okay, so it's Peter's idea. Okay, let's put more infrastructure there so that we can accept this wind.
I would just add, in terms of making hydrogen offshore, There's a great bit of a wonderful little bit of American history to dig into. There's a guy named Bill Hieronymus, who is essentially the father of the U.S. wind industry. He got excited about wind power back in the 60s and created the program at the University of Massachusetts that created all the engineers that went forth. And he was talking in the late 60s. He was a nuclear engineer, by the way. And he was a big believer in renewable energy, and he was excited about the idea of offshore floating wind ships that would produce electricity and then convert it to hydrogen, which would then be brought ashore. And so, you know, that's definitely possible. I would say the nearer term opportunity is to build offshore grids. So you have, you know, DC power. DC is great for underwater power connections. It's what's usually used for underwater power connections. And you can essentially create an offshore grid, something that Europe is working on, so that you minimize the number of times that you have to come ashore, the number of places you have to disturb.
One of the potential for offshore wind is tremendous for electricity production. One of Jack's points that I don't agree with is that using renewables, solar or wind, to produce hydrogen that's then going to be burned to produce electricity is extremely wasteful. And it's a lot of energy, the initial energy, is lost in the two-stage process. Just use the renewables to produce the electricity.
Chris Clay.
It's a little more complicated than that, but anyways, from my perspective. Okay, go ahead.
It's all right. I'm perhaps a little ignorant here on hydrogen conversion to ammonia, but once you convert it to ammonia, and I was thinking about the fertilizer application issue, do you then have nitrous oxide emissions after that?
So ammonia can be cracked without nitrogen oxide emissions to make pure hydrogen, but if you want to burn the ammonia, absolutely you make nitrogen oxide emissions. So it depends what you're doing. If you want to make power by burning ammonia, that's going to make a lot of nitrogen oxides. As a matter of fact, people are investigating that in our lab right now, and it's not easy to get low NOx. So I think the better strategy is not to burn it, but to, after you carry it, crack it, convert it to its nitrogen and hydrogen constituents, right, and then use the pure hydrogen in a fuel cell, and then you have zero emissions in its conversion.
Or I would just add to that it takes a lot of energy to convert back from ammonia to hydrogen. Probably makes more sense to just use it as ammonia. You know, we use a lot of ammonia and we produce it mostly from natural gas. So the low-hanging fruit, and there's a lot of it, is simply to convert the entire ammonia industry over to green hydrogen.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. If you make ammonia, why not use it as ammonia? It's valuable that way. Yeah. Nice point.
I just had a quick question for Peter. He had made a comment that in Europe, green hydrogen was kicking blue hydrogen's butt, and I wondered if you could just elaborate on that. I must confess, when Jack mentioned the impacts of diesel pollution and the environmental justice, you know, if it's going to take significantly longer to bring green hydrogen online to replace diesel and ports and stuff like that, it's interesting, or it could be done faster if you combine some blue hydrogen, and then you had all the problems of methane and climate change, but maybe you had cleaned up the air, so you're producing those deaths. It's a different sort of equation than I thought about. I'm not saying that's the way to go. I'm just saying that's one more factor. But you're saying in Europe that, hey, green hydrogen is moving ahead. And so if you could just elaborate on that.
It's been a little while since I actually reported on this, but I do sort of keep an eye on the headlines. Basically, Europe has extremely large ambitions for green hydrogen. They have initiated the process of pushing industries like steel to start decarbonizing, and they have pilot projects at fairly significant scale. They have hydrogen hubs that are, nearing
hydrogen valleys.
Getting closer to operation at fairly large scale, there's been sort of a battle over whether blue hydrogen should have access
to the various incentive schemes that are behind these projects. And it's not that blue hydrogen has been completely eliminated, but I think it's pretty clear that that there's a strong preference for green. And I think where you might see blue playing a role is with gas, North Sea gas, stuff that's coming down from Scandinavia. I think they'll probably make some exceptions there. But yeah, in terms of the incentive schemes, it's very much skewing towards green hydrogen.
Let me say that because of the current policy in the United States, I think it actually will evolve somewhat like you just described, because there are going to be some incentives for blue hydrogen, okay, that will encourage some of that to be used. And if we use that hydrogen then in, for example, long-haul trucks or ships, it does have the additional benefit of air quality improvements. So, okay, again, I'm not a big fan of it because I think investing in that when it's got to go away anyway, I'm not a fan of it, but it's going to happen like that in this country. And so if we're going to make blue hydrogen, first of all, we should get rid of all those methane leaks in the whole gas system. That's horrid, okay? Secondly, we should use that hydrogen then in an application that reduces criteria pollutant emissions so that we have air quality benefits.
I think this will be the last question.
All right, I'll try to make it a good one. I'm James Binney, and I'm a reporter with New Scientist. Question for Jack. How might the transmission and distribution improvements to the grid you're talking about change the amount of surplus renewable energy that might be available for hydrogen production? Hmm. And related to that, where is there the most potential for hydrogen production to compete with other electrification?
Okay, I don't think hydrogen should be described as competing with electrification. We should electrify as much as we possibly can and always use renewable electricity whenever it's available. And we should start having demand response follow that sun and wind power. Okay, this is always preferred to hydrogen or even battery storage for that matter. So the transmission system will help tremendously for that first purpose. Right? Because right now we can't actually move the electricity from where it's mostly being generated in the eastern portion of Southern California to Northern California or over to the basin where we have most of the demand. Okay, so this is super important, okay? And it's going to enable more electrification directly first. Okay, this is super important. And then when you have that happening, you will have less excess, okay, already. But if you saw the expected required amount of sun and wind power that we need and the trajectory that we're currently on, if we only build transmission, we're not going to get all the way there, I suggest. I think we need transmission and hydrogen. And hydrogen will enable electrification of ships, steel, cement, by making it from electricity and then distributing it to where those end uses are. Okay, so I think we need both of these things, and it's not competing. It's electrifying those applications that you can't put a heat pump in, or you can't do use the electricity directly.
Yeah, and I would just add that and I meant to mention this when I was talking about Europe, answering the last question, that the challenges of building the grid are part of the reason why they're interested in hydrogen. They see moving gas as an alternative to building more power lines, which are unpopular. So you're already seeing offshore wind projects, or places where the European governments are offering parcels and companies are bidding into that. Some of those are being set aside for offshore wind to hydrogen projects. Right, so where you're already contemplating going directly from offshore wind to hydrogen so that you don't have to move the electrons across the power grid.
I'm so sorry, I have to get running.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Jack, and all the other panelists. Very edifying conversation. And it looks like these guys are sticking around if you have any other questions. Thanks, everyone.